listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean, with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Tony, we've got a lot of ground to cover, as always, and we might as well start in Venezuela at the bottom of the alphabet instead of the top. How you doing?
Right. Yeah, what's going on in Venezuela is fascinating and obviously absolutely crucial for the future stability of the region. Currently what's happening is that the opposition and the government have continued to maintain their talks in the Dominican Republic, facilitated by various other governments in the region from both right and left political positions, very much against the opposition of the United States, which has consistently tried to sabotage those talks because they don't want to see a situation in which the Venezuelan opposition abandoned their efforts to destabilize the government of Nicolas Maduro. In Venezuela itself, what the government has done is they've consulted with the Constituent National Assembly about whether to bring forward the presidential elections originally scheduled for December of this year. And what the decision is that the elections will be brought forward to sometime before April, but a date has yet to be fixed.
Right.
And that's very important because there's a lot of debate in the government circles and in the among its supporters of Chavismo in Venezuela, which is essentially the legacy of Comandante Hugo Chavez and everything that he tried to build over the 15 years before he died. when he was in government, leading the government in Venezuela. And Chavismo were arguing, well, would it be better to wait? Is it a good idea to bring the elections forward? And eventually the decision among the Chavista majority that prevails in the National Constituent Assembly was the election should be brought forward.
Yeah, unanimously, by the way. That was a unanimous decision, and it's actually before the end of April, so it may include April, but yeah.
Right.
And then the United States rejected it. I don't understand what is the legal process exactly? Elected body in Venezuela decides when elections should be held. Then do they have to go see the viceroy from the United States and get that signed off on? There's a congressional vote, and then they said no. Is that how it works? Because that's what it looks like on paper here.
Yeah, and the European Union as well, and the so-called Lima Group.
Right.
Of U.S. allies in South America mainly,
yeah.
Criticized the decision. But as you said, it's a sovereign decision of the Venezuelan people, and that's
right.
What they decided. And it's very much in line with what the Venezuelan opposition, have themselves been calling for, or were calling for. They were calling for presidential elections to be brought forward. And now, obviously, because of their disappointing results in the elections, the regional elections, the elections on the Constituent Assembly itself, the municipal elections, they had extremely disappointing results, and virtually getting wiped out in most of those elections. So now they've changed their mind. Now they don't want the elections to come earlier rather than later. They'd rather so. So that's what's going to happen. There'll be elections before the end of April, as you say. And in that process, the Supreme Court has now ruled that the United Electoral Ticket, the so-called United Democratic Table, which is a kind of broad representative ticket covering all the Venezuelan opposition parties, they've been disqualified from the elections, but not the component parties. And the reason that the Supreme Court took that decision was because under Venezuela's electoral law, long-standing electoral law, two parties can't present their ticket to participate in elections under two separate names. Obviously, only one party can present its ticket to participate in an election, and it can't then participate in some other political organization, because it just doesn't make sense. And so, and that's essentially the ruling that the Supreme Court has made, so that if the MUD were to present itself as a ticket, it would have to have a strong formal structure with clearly identifiable leaders and representatives and officials. And currently it doesn't, because there's so much internal division within the opposition. They've been unable to maintain the structural institutional unity of the MUD. And that's what led to this decision by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, well, I'm guessing also that it must be difficult to be objective in the Supreme Court when you have to make an adjudication against or for a party that in its spare time slams helicopters against your court building. It seems like they're going, running from hot and cold to let's try to blow up the court. Hey, let's make an application to alter the electoral map.
Yeah, and one of the extraordinary things about events over the last year is the tolerance with which the authorities have actually behaved.
Right.
And it seems now that they maintain that tolerance in order to avoid precisely the kind of provocation that the opposition were trying to bring about.
Right.
And now that things have calmed down, they're in a position to be able to take the measures that they should have taken many, many months ago.
Right.
Anyway, and that's the situation in Venezuela. The talks are proceeding and have made very good progress. Some reports suggest that there's 98% agreement on, I think it's a total of 6 points that are in dispute between the two sides. And they've got to the point where they've said that they've reached a pre-agreement, and that they hope to sign a complete agreement early next week. So let's see what happens. Yeah. And that's that'd be very important for regional stability.
Okay.
So, in general, trying to take a broad panorama of what's going on in the region, and the situation in Venezuela and Colombia is very, very important. In Colombia, it remains to be seen if the government either has the will or the ability to implement the peace agreement that that created so much hope and expectation both in Colombia and the region, but which is being kind of piecemeal in a piecemeal way subverted and not yet destroyed, but there are very, very serious problems in Colombia because the government seems incapable of protecting community leaders, protecting the former guerrilla fighters who are now trying to participate in the electoral process. That Colombia has presidential elections. I think it's in May. Yeah. So there's that electoral process happening, and what's happening is that the paramilitaries, to some extent, it's not clear to what extent, but obviously to some extent in collusion with some segments of the Colombian authorities, either at departmental level or municipal level, and perhaps even at national level in terms of the Army High Command. It's just not clear what's going on.
Right.
But the paramilitaries are murdering community activists, they're murdering FARC politicians, and there doesn't seem to be any strong policy or will on the part of the government to bring that under control and clamp down on it.
Well, this, we saw this as this, I mean, you mentioned it up front that, first of all, this is pretty much the way the last effort broke down, is that when you had a surrender of arms by the guerrilla groups, and that now that they were vulnerable, they essentially became targets and were targeted by either the state directly or by the right-wing proxies.
Yeah, and what I find curious in a sad way is why do progressive movements in these countries in here in Latin America and the Caribbean think that the international community is somehow going to play a role that promotes justice? And it's just it's such a forlorn hope, isn't it? And the United Nations, they look at the United Nations record, for example, in Haiti and other places.
Right.
And so this is a theme that we see constantly in places like Colombia and Honduras where there are very acute conflicts. For example, in Honduras, the opposition had hoped that the United Nations would the comments of the United Nations would facilitate some kind of more satisfactory resolution of the conflict than has in fact happened, and you know all that's happened is that Juan Orlando Hernandez in Honduras has he rode out all the protests, held his phony presidential inauguration. So that he is now the de facto president of Honduras, despite the clearly fraudulent election results.
Right.
Why do people continue anywhere in the world, but here in Latin America is what we're talking about? Why do people continue to put faith in the international community, the United Nations, international institutions, when they know they're up against extremely ruthless, murderous, entrenched oligarchic interests?
Right.
And so.
Right. I mean, these are the same people that oh, well, we're going to be the international observers that will sign off on the legitimacy of your, you know, electoral process. You know, at the same time that they're mouthing that nonsense, they're certifying, you know, thefts that were done in plain view of the whole world, like Honduras.
Yeah, and so taking all that into account, taking into account the current situation in Colombia, and looking at the way all these Lima group governments, you're talking about Argentina, Chile, Peru, Mexico, Colombia itself, Paraguay, even Santa Lucia, one of the small Caribbean island nations, and they're all members of this Lima group, and they're all right-wing governments. They're all criticizing the peace process in Venezuela. They're criticizing the bringing forward of the elections in Venezuela, and they're the ones that turn a blind eye to, as you just said, to fraud in countries like Honduras, to extreme violence by their putative right-wing allies in Colombia, you know, threatens the viability of the peace process there. But they have nothing to say about all that. Yeah. And you can see that reflected, for example, in the treatment of the situation in Argentina, where the Argentinian government is behaving in an extremely repressive way. The justice system is being abused wholesale to attack political opponents, just as it is in Brazil, in the case, for example, it's much more urgent now, the case against former President Ignacio Lula da Silva. And we're likely to see that again also in Ecuador. And before we talk about Ecuador, let's take a quick look at the elections in Costa Rica.
Before the idea of the Lima group fades away from our consciousness here, we're talking about Lima, the capital of Peru. What an example. Right now, the Fujimori family is playing Family Feud there. Half of them are trying to undo the last election, in essence, and get rid of President Kaczynski, who defeated Fujimori's daughter. The Fujimori who was president that's in jail, his daughter lost the election. They're not settling with it. They're organizing chaos in the country. And one of the sons of Fujimori is now backing President Kaczynski, and so It's like Family Feud around the government there. This is Lima, Peru, the Lima group. This is the example I guess they're supposed to be setting for places like you just described, and now Costa Rica.
Yeah, and that theme of splits in the opposition and so forth. That's something that we should perhaps look at when we have more time.
Yeah. I just wanted to give people a little context when you say Lima Group. It's not like we're talking about something that was, you know, done, you know, sanctioned in heaven or something. Au contraire.
Why is there that crisis in Peru? Because, and the popular support for the politicians in Peru is heavily split. There are all kinds of mini crises going on in different sectors of Peru's political life, and perhaps that's always true, but it seems to be especially true in the current situation in Latin America, and that's reflected in what's going on in Costa Rica. Costa Rica, a very prosperous Central American country, although its economic situation relative to other countries in Central America is not as prosperous as it was, and the electoral situation there reflects deep insecurity, deep uncertainty that is current across the region in many ways, and Costa Rica is a kind of small example of a much broader phenomenon whereby people are fed up with corrupt politicians. They're fed up with the inability of their political parties, their political leaders, and their country's institutions to solve their problems. And you can see that very much reflected in the situation in Costa Rica, where there are 15 presidential candidates. something you're unlikely ever to see in the United States. Of those, maybe four or five have a realistic chance of perhaps getting through to the second round, because it's very rare in Costa Rica for they have a two-round presidential election. On the first round, if the leading candidate doesn't get a very clear majority over 50%, I think that's the rule, then the election goes to a runoff between
40%.
The two leading candidates.
Yeah, 40% is the cutoff. Each candidate must receive at least 40% if no candidate wins in the first round, and the win is a 50% win, right?
Okay. Well done, Don. I hadn't got that detail.
No, that's okay. There you go.
Yeah. So, in fact, there are kind of three leading candidates, and none of them inspire broad support among the Costa Rican electorate. And the two of them are quite right wing. One of them is the representative of the party currently in government, and none of them are very inspiring. But right. And if the candidate of the current government party manages to get through to the second round, he's likely to win. So I'm very, very little change in Costa Rica. And so from that point of view, it's not especially interesting. But what's interesting about the election is the way it reflects a strong entrenched disenchantment with the conventional politics and the conventional political parties that have traditionally held power in the region. Mm. And then that is also reflected in another very, very, and what some people regard as an absolutely crucial vote for the region's political direction, perhaps not. That's not the best way to put it. It's a crucial vote in terms of whether the right wing will be able to entrench its power in the region,
right.
And continue to erode the possibility of access to power of their progressive opponents, and that this goes back to what we've been talking about in many conversations now about what the resurgence of right-wing governments in the region is not due to their overwhelming popular support. Right. It's due to their ability, their ability to exploit their inherited privilege and their accumulated economic advantage and social advantage as oligarchs. They can exploit their control over society to sabotage due democratic process. We're seeing this in Brazil. We're seeing it now in Argentina.
Right.
And now that right-wing conspiracy to sabotage due process and rig it in their favor, even if they have to use fraud to do so or illegitimate means to do so, abusing the justice system, for example, you can see that process now coming to a head in Ecuador, and that's what this vote on February the 4th is really all about. It's about whether also in Ecuador the right wing will be able to engineer via abuse of the country's institutions that they've controlled for decades, for centuries. What they've been able to do is to co-opt somebody who actually came to office on the progressive ticket,
right,
of the government of Rafael Correa.
Yeah, the people elected a leftist government. They elected Correa's, you know, successor, like another term of Correa, who was term limited out, and so they voted for Moreno, and then Moreno went in and said, "Oh, by the way, it's all a joke. I'm a rightist. We're going to change everything around and go back to the, you know, here's my new pals," and he's pointing to the people on the right. And then Correa says, "Okay, well, I guess I got to come back in then. Let's have a referendum on my being able to run in all of this." And Moreno's campaigning against it. And they're organizing against it, and they're manipulating the government against it.
Yeah, and the The vote on Sunday is it's actually a referendum on Sunday, and, right. and it's actually an illegal referendum because it was called by Lenin Moreno without satisfying the terms that the Ecuadorian constitution stipulates in terms of getting a decision of approving the referendum from the country's Supreme Court. So, and Rafael Correa has been very insistent in criticizing this referendum exercise for that very reason. Now, Lenin Moreno is trying to justify it as a consulta popular, a popular consultation designed to reinforce democracy in Ecuador. But if you look at the terms of there are seven questions on the referendum. And some of them are political, some of them are economic, and some of them are apparently environmental. But almost all of them are phony kind of trick questions, because while superficially they look reasonable, what they actually mean in terms of Ecuador's politics is something very different. And the first question is an unexceptionable question about the battle against corruption, fighting corruption. And its subtext is that people like Jorge Glass, the former vice president, who was actually elected vice president with Lenin Moreno, and then was essentially betrayed by President Lenin Moreno and thrown to the wolves judicially, and thrown into jail on corruption charges, but only on the evidence of tainted witnesses. There was no substantive evidence against Jorge Glass. And the first question in the referendum is, should people who are convicted of corruption be barred from life, from right. participating in political life? And right. so that's clearly part of what we're seeing elsewhere in Brazil and Argentina, for example.
Right. We have control of the government. We make it illegal for people that are convicted of embezzlement or whatever to hold office. We then go out and find our political enemies and convict them of embezzlement, this, right. that, or whatever.
Right. So then there's that. Then the second question is perhaps the most crucial question, but you can argue about which of these is most important. In Latin America, they continually talk about the need to prevent indefinite re-election. And this is always a right-wing theme.
Right.
And what they mean is they want to stop popular progressive candidates from having the right to stand in elections. That's
right.
what that
right. Got it.
Means. Right. And that has because the argument here in Nicaragua in the case of Daniel Ortega, the argument in Ecuador now in the case of Rafael Correa, the argument in Bolivia in the case of Evo Morales is, what's democratic about denying the people the right to elect who they want?
Especially, let's look at, we're talking about Correa here, because Correa had suggested he might return to Ecuador and run against Moreno in 2021. Okay, so Correa runs in 2021. Moreno is the president. He's got the full power of the state. He's got all the time yeah. between now and then to build constituencies by doing things for this group or that group or whatever. And so, the part that's stacked in favor of incumbents will be against Correa, not in his favor. What is undemocratic about him running and letting the people elect him if that's what they choose to do?
Right, but the right-wing argument is that it's inherently undemocratic to allow people to stand for right. Election if they've already been president for one or two terms.
Right.
So then that second question in the referendum is clearly aimed at excluding Rafael Correa from ever presenting himself for the presidency again. Question three is also very, very important. Question three is about what we mentioned briefly at the end of our last conversation, the Citizen Participation Council, which is one of the powers of state that was set up in the new constitution Ecuador voted for back in 2006 or 2007, whenever it was. Called the Constitution of Monte Cristi. And that constitution created another two powers of state, one of which, apart from the executive, the judiciary, and the legislature,
right.
and one of those extra powers was this Citizen Participation Council, which
right.
is a council designed to promote ordinary people's control of and participation in the institutions of the state.
Including several cabinet-level officers. In other words, really what it is a check on presidential power from the popular, right. You know, by the people.
Oh, very good, Don. And that's exactly what it is. And so...
They want to undo that. That's the yes vote would undo that. They got to resign, and no political parties or coalitions are allowed to have members on it.
Right. So and that's very, very clearly a move by Lenin Moreno and his right-wing backers and allies to get back control into the oligarchy, the institutions of the state traditionally controlled by the oligarchy. Essentially, what Lenin Moreno is doing is he's kind of carrying out a very subtle and cynical fraud on the people of Ecuador. He's right. saying, let's have this exercise in democracy, but if right. he gets the results he wants,
I'll be a dictator. That's right.
It'll set Ecuador back 20 years in terms of its political development.
Democracy. And the remaining three questions have to do with certain types of economic issues, and I wouldn't be surprised if there were some looting hiding behind each of these.
The question four about protecting children is...
Oh, question four, right. Sorry, sex abuse.
It's pretty much... You know, everybody will agree about that.
That's right.
Question five about metallic mining in protected areas, that's right. not what it looks like either, but it essentially makes no real change to the status quo. It's just window dressing to make nice with the indigenous people's organization.
And it's also to bring some of these things, including question four about, predators, child sexual abuse, they're clearly engineered to guarantee turnout. In other words, right. I'm going to go vote. I was abused by a priest or whatever in, eighth grade. I'm going to go out and vote. Oh, while I'm there, how am I going to vote on these other things?
that's right. And I know that we're running out of time. I want to talk about question six, which is a capital gain. It's a law about capital gains. In Ecuador, it's called La Ley de Plusvalía. And it was an attempt by Rafael Correa and his ministerial colleagues to bring speculation on land values right. under control.
Right.
What Lenin Moreno wants to do is to go back to the status quo ante.
Right. They want to undo that. There was a tax imposed, almost 75%, to prevent speculation. He wants to open it up, and we are out of time. So we'll pick it up here next week, Tony. Appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Okay. You're very welcome, Don. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Turkey's decision to invade northern Syria has foreign policy implications far beyond the Middle East. What are Ankara's objectives in Syria and the region? Does it facilitate or hinder a final peace settlement to Syria's proxy civil war? And what is Turkey's future in NATO? Crosstalking Turkey and Syria, I'm joined by my guest Sami Ramadani in London. He is a contributor on Iraq and the Middle East for The Guardian, as well as a senior lecturer in sociology. In Oxford, we have Dan Glazebrook. He is an independent political analyst and author of Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in the Age of Crisis. And in Istanbul, we cross to Cengiz Tomar. He is dean of political sciences at Marmara University. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Cengiz in Istanbul, let me go to you first here. Just very simply, what is Turkey's aims, what is its strategic goals in Syria since the incursion into northern Syria? Can you give us, two or three major points what Turkey wants to achieve?
Actually, yes, we have two, three points very clear. The first of all, Turkey wants to get rid of this PKK we can say a branch of Syria. This is we call it YPG or PYD. This is the first and the most crucial strategic point for Turkey. Secondly, after cleaning this area, to put some are Syrian immigrants. You know, we have 3.5 million Syrian immigrants in Turkey. To put them, some of them, to create some kind of buffer zone between Turkey and Syria or Iraq, and we can say it's a safe zone in Syria. And also, I think, this is my prediction, that Turkey wants to be, how can I say, it's after the political table, like Geneva or Sochi or Astana, whatever you call it, it wants to be there on the table with a good, you know, card. So that's why, and, you know, these three reasons, more strategic aims of Turkey in northern Syria.
Okay, but I have to point out that you didn't say the word Kurds once, okay? And that's really what it's all about here. You know, Sammy, I'll be really honest with you. I can understand Turkey's position, okay? I do understand it. I don't necessarily agree with it. But I will tell you something, Sammy. I understand the position of all the major players when it comes to Syria, except for one country, the United States. I don't understand what it is doing in Syria. I mean, what we're all told is that, you know, the sacred cow NATO must be preserved. But U.S. policy is driving a huge wedge between the two countries that have the largest military and NATO. I mean, who's making this policy in the U.S.?
Well, for the United States and Syria, most of the proxy forces that they relied upon have been either defeated or on the way of being defeated in Syria. What entrenched or increased their presence in Syria is this dramatic development of gaining the YPG, practically, really, unfortunately, and very sadly, from my point of view, that the YPG, the Kurdish group, has decided to make an alliance with the United States.
Big
in
mistake.
In fact, General Ray...
The Kurds always choose the wrong side. I mean, historically, they do this, and they have done it again. Dan, let me...
It's very sad, very sad.
Yeah, okay. Dan, let me go to you. What is the possibility that we're going to see Turkish and U.S. forces go head to head? Because the U.S. seems to, and it seems to me, it's a policy of spite. It is a spoiler. It lost the war. Assad's still there, and it wants to spite the Russians and the Iranians. But that's really childish thinking when you think about it. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, it's a spoiler, but I don't agree that there's this collision course necessarily on the cards between Ankara and Washington. I mean, from Washington's point of view, the thing is their goal is to just weaken and preferably destroy any independent force in the global south. That's the big strategy, right? And so that includes the Syrian state.
I agree.
And frankly, that includes a potentially independent, strong Kurdish force, and it includes Turkey. So if they see the Turks and the YPG tearing themselves apart, that fits okay into the U.S. game plan, and if they're doing it inside Syria, all the better. So I don't see this as so at odds with Washington's strategy. Okay, they made this announcement; they wanted a border force, and it's put the spoiler on that. But there's many ways to destroy a country. There's not many ways to build up a country, but there's many ways to destroy it.
So I guess what you're saying, there is a method. There's a method to their madness. Go ahead, jump in Istanbul. Go ahead.
Okay, because I would like to add something about American policy. We are in Turkey, as you know, government and people mostly think that America tried to create a satellite Kurdish zone between Turkey and Syria and Iraq in order to use this policy to educate Turks, Persians, and Arabs. And also it is good for Israel to be created a satellite, not independent, dependent to United States, create a zone. It is perfect for America. And most of people in Turkey, most of interpreters and all, you know, columnists, they think that we have some, you know, America has something like that as a project. to create small Kurdish zones.
So, okay, so the United States
I agree.
No, but
that
I mean,
was a potential.
But Dan, so the U.S. is exporting democracy and, you know, and liberalism and all that. I'm sorry. It's a fairy tale,
no,
but it's
okay,
not
this,
true.
This border force.
Go ahead, Dan. Go ahead.
It might have wanted to create a little, basically, Syrian Kosovo out of YPG areas in Syria and lead to an effective partition. And it was actually not so much the announcement of the border force, but the announcement that the 2,000 U.S. troops, the announcement by Tillerson, that the 2,000 U.S. troops were basically going to stay there effectively permanently. I mean, the wish list of what you wanted to achieve was made it effective permanent. I mean, they're not going to achieve any of those things anytime soon. So that was what really told the Turks, look, they're basically going to stay. U.S. Air power and on the ground presence is going to establish basically an independent state within a state. And of course, they couldn't abide that. But as I say, okay, so that partition was one possible way to destroy the Syrian state. But the Kurds and Turks destroying each other is another way to achieve, frankly, similar goals of the destruction of Syria and the weakening of Turkey and the weakening of the Kurds.
Go ahead, Sammy, jump in. It's the point of the program.
Yeah, just one other issue, I think, which needs mentioning, is that Turkey itself, unfortunately, takes quite a bit of the blame for the destruction in Syria, for the support and backing for terrorist groups inside Syria. Its only conflict has been within Syria in recent times is with the Kurds of Syria, and they got frightened because the United States started backing the YPG and arming it. But really, Turkey should also shoulder quite a lot of the responsibility for the mayhem that has unfolded in both Syria and in Iraq, by the way, where they still have some forces inside Iraq as well. And their policy towards the Kurdish people over many decades has been really bad. It must be mentioned that the Kurdish people have suffered enormously from successive Turkish regimes. Tens of thousands of Kurds have died inside Turkey. And this so-called cleansing inside Syria, Turkey is in effect committing aggression against a sovereign state, the Syrian state, which has objected officially to the entry of Turkish troops. So there are ramifications.
Sure.
And there is the other point I wanted to raise, there is some genuine friction between Turkey and the United States since the coup attempt last year, which seems to have had U.S. support to overthrow Erdogan.
Okay. Cengiz, go ahead in Istanbul, jump in.
Yes. Yeah, actually, you know, it's, in Turkey, you know, something like 40 years we have Kurdish problems, but this is not really, really Kurdish problems. Turkey was against not the Kurdish people, and Kurdish people live, you know, in very good standards according to, if you compare with other countries such as Syria, Iraq, and Iran. But the PKK guerrillas, you know, or terrorist groups, Turkish, one of the big problems, and they are the main cause to kill Kurdish people. Even this PKK, this is a Kurdish, they claim that it's Kurdish independence group. They kill a lot of Kurds in Turkey and also Turks as well, you know. And Turkey is, as a state, it has no problem with Kurdish citizens in Turkey. They live peacefully and more democratically than Syria, Iraq, and Iran. If we come to Syrian issue, in the beginning, Turkey with the United States and with European allies, in order to support, you know, freedom against Bashar Assad regime, but after 2013,
okay, well,
America, America left Turkey alone.
Let me jump in here, go to Dan before we go to the break here. I mean, but at the same time, you know, outside powers, that's why I say proxy civil war, because this is from the outside, okay? I mean, bringing democracy to Syria is the last thing this has all been about, okay? It's been arming jihadists to overthrow a legitimate government. Okay, go ahead, Dan, before we go to the break.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you say, and I just wanted to comment on what Sammy was saying. There is friction between the U.S. and Turkey, and I would say that predates the coup attempt, actually. In fact, really it goes back to the downing of the Russian plane.
Yeah.
I would read that, it was seen obviously correctly as a low point in Russian-Turkish relations, but I see that really as a last-ditch attempt
let me jump
by
in
Turkey
here.
To try
Dan,
and force the US to put their
We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Turkey and Syria. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Dan in Oxford. I hate going to hard breaks like that, but it happens, okay? So I'm going to go let you finish your point here. With the proviso here, I'm really glad we went to this point in talking about U.S.-Turkey relations, because in the foreign policy blob sphere in Washington, the great swamp of America, I mean, there's plenty of people that are writing off Turkey completely, saying even we don't need them in NATO. I mean, and this is in the National Security Council. This is in the State Department, Defense Department. I mean, there's a raging debate going on in the intelligence community as well, is how important they want, because this is what it gets down to. It's who's calling who's bluff. And I hate that, okay, because everybody's got arms, okay? What is going on in Turkey-U.S. relations? This is what's really key here. Dan, please keep going.
Yeah, so after the downing of the Russian jet, Turkey was hoping that this would force somehow the U.S. to actually come good on what they had seen as the U.S. promises to make this regime change happen. Turkey, at huge cost to itself, had allowed itself to be the spearhead of this Western imperial regime change policy in Syria, and it seemed to be doing so with very little actual help from the West in doing so. So it really wanted to force the U.S. to put the cards on the table. That help wasn't forthcoming. So at that point, thought, okay, they're not serious. We're going to have to basically do something else, cut some kind of deal, or think again. And it's interesting, and no coincidence, I think, that a month before the coup attempt was when there's the famous phone call between Putin and Erdogan, and Erdogan began to make noises about perhaps Assad has some sort of bit longer future than we'd at first thought, and relations began to improve. That was when the coup attempt happened. So the U.S. is very worried. It is bluffing that it can do without Turkey and NATO. It's very worried about losing Turkey. Turkey is very angry at U.S. at having been used and abused for its regime change project. But I think Turkey's walked into a trap, because at the same time as I don't think the U.S. is particularly that troubled by what's happening in Syria right now. It is happy to see Turkey weakened, because it calls it Operation Olive Branch. I think Operation Birch Tree would be a better name, because Turkey is really beating itself here. It's weakening itself at the same time as weakening the Kurds. And it's really, once again, helping to facilitate U.S. strategy at no benefit to itself.
Yeah. You know, Sammy, I talk about that because, I keep reading from the foreign policy blob sphere, Turkey has to choose between Moscow and Washington. I don't buy that at all. As a matter of fact, because NATO has no useful value whatsoever, Turkey is coming into its own. Now, it may be walking into a trap, but it's coming into its own as a regional player dealing with other countries. And we have this constellation where we have Baghdad, Damascus, Beirut. All of them are on the same page. It doesn't happen very often. And Turkey is getting into the parlay here. I mean, this is something that I think is really interesting. I worry about Turkey because I really did like, the no problems foreign policy. Well, it has a lot of problems right now. But is this kind of a major paradigm shift, Sammy, in the region with what's going on with Turkey?
It's possible. I think it all depends on whether the United States is going to dig its heels in Manbij and other areas where there are U.S. troops patrolling the streets alongside YPG forces. Now, this is where the main conflict is between Turkey and the United States. I do not think Turkey will retreat on the Kurdish question.
I agree.
And the United States is in a sense, in a lose-lose situation. I slightly differ from Dan there, that the United States is losing in Iraq, is losing in Syria, and they are in a fix because they either send more troops, which they are loath to do, but because they would like to rely on proxy forces after their debacles in Afghanistan and Iraq, they started using proxy forces, whether in Libya, Syria, Iraq, and so on. And in Syria, they found a golden opportunity with about 40,000 YPG fighters, whom the general of the Special Forces of the United States, General Raymond Thomas Raymond, he himself called them a proxy force.
Yeah.
But if Turkey is going to go all out to prevent the emergence of such a Kurdish enclave backed by the United States, then we are looking at a serious contradiction between the United States and Turkey. Okay. And I think ultimately it's the United States which will retreat on that one. Otherwise, they will lose Turkey completely.
But they tend to take everybody down with them before they leave. Cengiz, let me go to you. I mean, how important is all of this to the Turkish president? Because he's invested a lot in Syria and he's gotten very little in return. I think Dan is spot on. He was egged on by the U.S. and the U.S. basically folded. I mean, what are the political repercussions for the president, Erdogan, if he doesn't get what he wants? Go ahead.
Actually, yes. And now, you know, it's after a year, we have very important elections in Turkey presidency. And it is the first time in 2019. And before that, I think Turkey tried to finish or wrap up the Syrian issue with some gains. You know, in the beginning, we started with the United States and the European allies, and then they left us with Russia and Iran in the region. Now, after 2015, Turkey started a new strategy on his own, sometimes with the help of Russia and Iran in Syrian issue. We have basically three, you know, European shield and then Idlib. And then this olive branch operations, these are very important operations for Turkey. And I think it's Turkish people is supporting these kind of operations. And after that, the return will come to Manbij. I think this is the Manbij is most crucial area between Turkey and United States, because an American army is there. If Turkey goes further to Manbij, it might be a problem for Turkey. This is, I think, most crucial thing up to now. But for its olive branch operation, I think no problem with United States. United States does not interfere this operation. But if Turkey goes further to Manbij, it will be problematic for the region. And maybe Turkey and United States will be head to head in that area.
Well,
President Erdogan has support in Turkey.
Yeah, well, that's why I keep saying who's bluffing whom here. And Dan, also the one can surmise, and if you look at the long bad blood between Iran and the United States, is one of the reasons why the United States wants to keep a footprint there. You know, it really is quite amazing. They're doing the bidding of Riyadh and Tel Aviv all the time, because there is absolutely no strategic interest of the United States or anyone in the European Union about Syria. And I think that's what backs it all up. And you know, it's always misguided. The more they listen to Riyadh and to Tel Aviv, the opposite happens. Iran's influence continues to expand. When are they going to learn? Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, that's true. Iran has in some ways benefited from the disasters wreaked on the Middle East by the U.S. in the last few decades. But I would completely disagree that Europe and the U.S. have no interest in containing Iran or destroying Syria. The U.S. certainly does, and the West in general, and especially Britain and the USA, are very concerned to, as I said right at the outset, to destroy any independent or potentially independent force in the global south. Israel and Saudi Arabia are the bulldogs, if you like, of Western power in the Middle East. They're the watchdogs keeping that area basically under the domination of the United States and Britain. So I don't buy into this idea of saying, oh, the US is doing the bidding of Tel Aviv and Riyadh. They're part of the same program of maintaining Middle East under Western domination, maintaining the global oil production and on the levels that they want it, at the price they want it, in the, being sold in the currency that they want, in the dollar, and so on. I don't see these as necessarily separate.
Yeah, but okay, but let me go to Sammy. I think you have bring up very interesting points, Dan, and I don't necessarily disagree with them. But Sammy, you know, going back to what I said earlier, if we can just start, and it's not arbitrary, 2003, and go all the way up to the present, every single strategic initiative the United States and its allies have initiated in the Middle East have failed, and there's been only blowback. Okay, I mean, this ridiculous policy that Tillerson announced that anyone that sends aid to Syria will face sanctions. I mean, that is, you know, what they want to do is they just want to keep, and I'm going to agree with Dan here, is just to keep every single player weak and broken, okay? And that's going to backfire as well, okay? Because the region is going to stay, not necessarily outside players. They don't always stay. They usually leave. Go ahead, Sammy.
I think the main reason for their failure, and you're right to point to their failure, is that there is enormous opposition to their presence in the region. If we talk about the Middle East and all the way to Libya and so on, there is popular opposition to their presence. And there is this fundamental contradiction between the United States' aims of trying to control the region for its own interests and the interests of the peoples of the region. And there is no way this contradiction can be resolved unless the United States withdraws from the area, admits defeat, and gets out. This is unlikely to happen, so therefore we have this continuous conflict of U.S. imperialism trying to dominate the region and the peoples of the region insisting on their independence. And they are mad against Iran because Iran, regardless of what we think of its political system, is a very independent country from U.S. policies. And this they hate, and I agree with Dan there, that they are, they want to crush any possibility of independence.
That's Iran's greatest sin, its sovereignty. Gentlemen, we've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in London, Oxford, and in Istanbul. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.